Welcome to Season 2 of the Console Podcast. I'm David Mitten, co-founder of console.dev, a free weekly newsletter highlighting the best and most interesting tools for developers. In this season, I'll be interviewing 11 interesting people about a specific technical topic, from security to dev-focused infrastructure, and from homomorphic encryption to privacy and decentralization. We'll get into the details covering what developers need to know. In this first episode, I speak with John Graham Cumming, CTO of Cloudflare, a global web platform built for security and performance. We discuss the philosophy behind the idea that the network is the computer, why developers should be able to ignore the low-level details of where their code runs, and the challenges of deploying data centers on Mars. We're keeping this to 30 minutes, so let's get started. I'm here with John Graham Cumming. John, thanks for joining the Console Podcast.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's lovely to get a chance to chat.
Let's start with a brief background then. Tell us a little bit about what you're currently doing and how you got here.
Well, I'm John Graham Cumming. I'm the CTO of a company called Cloudflare. How did I get here? Well, I got here because I met Matthew Prince, the CEO of Cloudflare, years and years and years ago. So long ago, I don't want to tell you how long ago it was. And I had had a long career in a sequence of unsuccessful or relatively unsuccessful startups, following on from having done computer science and mathematics at university. And somehow, you know, Cloudflare, I wanted to work for Matthew. I wanted to work for Michelle. And luckily, it turned out not to be just good people to work for, but a company that has become very successful.
Well, Cloudflare started life focused on some core network services like content delivery, security, and DDoS protection. But in the last few years, you've been working up the layers, and compute and storage are now core parts of the service. What's the philosophy behind this approach and the building blocks?
Well, I think the ideas were a few different aspects. We saw, you know, when you're talking about now, you know, 2010, 2011, that only a few companies really got the best out of the internet. And what I mean by that is, you know, they had the best security, they had the best performance, they gave you the best online experience. And the thing was, there were really a small number of them. If you think about like Amazon and Google, Yahoo at the time, you know, these were companies that could do all of that. And everyone else was sort of catching up. And we thought that that was silly, that the sort of the history of software really is that things tend to get more democratized. And it would be potentially a very successful thing to do to say, look, everybody should have the speed of Amazon, the security of Google, all that kind of thing. And so we really laid out a plan to bring those attributes to anything connected to the internet. And so, and over time, we have built that out. I mean, we started out with, you know, really for the web, really for websites, and really now it's anything connected to the internet.
And you have this concept of the network is the computer. What does that actually mean?
Well, I think that obviously that's an old slogan that came from Sun Microsystems. And, you know, Sun was really one of the first companies that was, you know, shipping all of its machines with network cards in them and seeing the network as fundamental to how things operate. I think what we mean by it now is that if you think about how we've got used to the cloud as something we just connect to, and we never talk about connecting to a server somewhere. Like the average person doesn't say, I'm going to go to my computer and connect to a remote server in order to access some data. They say something like, I'm going to use the internet or I'm going to use the cloud. And from the end user's perspective, the cloud, the internet, is this big computer. It just happens to be connected with networking stuff. And I think from a developer's perspective, the opposite is true, right? We're concentrating on the servers and the rollout and the scaling and the securing and all this kind of stuff. But we'd really quite like to treat it as just one big machine. And so that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make it a place you can put your content, put your code, and we'll worry about how we get it to the end user, how we scale it, how it gets secured. And that way, the network looks like a computer. And really, for me, it's just a lot of nostalgia, isn't it? Because I grew up in the 8-bit era, you know, where you had a computer in front of you, you wrote some code, and it just ran on that computer, and you didn't worry about anything else. So I'm really trying to bring the 8-bit age to the entire world and make it as easy as those days with a home computer in the 1980s.
Right, so developers don't have to worry about the idea of what is happening on the low level. They can just hand over the code, and you're dealing with and abstracting all of those difficult problems.
Yep. Exactly. There are times when it's interesting to worry about, you know, the performance of the machine, the architecture of the processor, you know, all the idiosyncrasies about, you know, the memory and everything. But there are many times you just want to run your code. And, you know, if you think about it, we stopped programming for the most part in assembly language quite a long time ago. And we started using compilers. I mean, compilers were this great innovation, right? Oh, you can actually write in the higher level language. And, you know, moving away from the hardware. And what we're really saying here is, yeah, let's just not worry about these underlying layers. Let's not even worry about the scaling, all those kind of things. We'll run your code for you and we'll run it where it needs to be run.
And how do you think that is exposed to developers? Because for a long time, you could just assume, well, your code's going to run on Intel architecture chips. But that's started to change quite a bit with Apple Silicon and ARM chips. And now you've got to deal with FPGAs and GPUs, and RISC is making a comeback. Do developers really need to care about all that?
Well, I mean, if you think about Intel, obviously, is a really, really popular platform. But the reality is that ARM is everywhere because it's in your phone. And, you know, there are billions and billions of phones. And so, you know, the idea that the Intel architecture was sort of dominant is actually kind of wrong. We're actually living in a world in which there are other architectures. And obviously, there were others like the Power architecture and obviously some of the, you know, Motorola things. I think that there are a group of people who need to worry about the underlying architecture. And they're writing operating systems and they're writing extremely high performance code. They're optimizing things for a particular type of hardware. And frankly, we do some of that because we need to. But most people are just writing to get a job done, right? So they are out there with some service to write or app to produce. And frankly, whether it's targeting ARM or whether it's targeting Intel is kind of irrelevant. I mean, I don't know, if you get on the plane, you mostly don't think if it's a Boeing or an Airbus. You mostly think about the destination. And I think that's what most engineers are thinking about when they write code.
What about network latency? Do developers need to care about that? How should they think about it?
Well, it depends what you're doing. I mean, I think that we are definitely entering an era where there will be low latency from an end user's device, be it a computer or a phone, to a place where their code runs. And the reason that's happening is not, sadly, that we made the speed of light faster, that we failed to do. But two things are going on. One is that we've moved a lot of the places where code gets executed closer to end users. And that's what serverless is about. That's what some of these edge compute things are about. They're about fighting against the speed of light and bringing stuff close to the end user. And the other thing is, we're going to get 5G at some point, and 5G is going to have lower latency. And so from a mobile device, you'll be getting down to very low latencies. And so I think we're going to enter a world in which the latency is much, much lower on average. And the interesting question is, how is that going to change things for developers? And I think the big question that's going to come about is, you know, do I put code on the end user device, be it, you know, JavaScript in a browser or an app or something like that? Or is it sufficient that I put it close to the end user on a serverless platform and I have a much thinner client on the end user device? And I think that's the world we're entering. And that's probably really the question developers will need to ask. Unless they're doing something that genuinely requires low latency, such as gaming or virtual reality or something, in which case they'll be seriously concentrating on latency from the beginning.
Does that assume much more processing either on the device or very close to the device as opposed to centralized?
Well, you know, if you think about the hyperscalers like Amazon, I mean, they've been very successful by building these very, very large data centers, right? And that's fantastic. I think that as we get to low latency, you're going to want to be near the end user. We're obviously already using quite powerful devices in general, but not everybody is. It's not uniform, right? People are using a variety of devices, you know, the computers they use or the phones they use. And we saw this in the pandemic, right? Where people got sent home, kids got sent home from school, and people's even schooling was depending on the types of machines their parents could afford to buy. And so you've got to realize that the end user stuff is not uniform. On the other hand, the edge compute platforms will tend to be very powerful. So depending on what you want to do, it may really make sense to push it into the edge, into the serverless platform, and not worry about the power on the end user device. And you really see this sometimes. Sometimes you see these incredible demos of stuff, and they look really good if you've got a gigabit connection and the latest Mac, but the average user doesn't. And so I think this does provide an opportunity to use the very high performance of these serverless platforms and, frankly, the really good connectivity of those serverless platforms. You know, if you're talking to other APIs or on other services, the fact they're really well connected means that you can do things really, really fast on the serverless platform. So I think there is really a future in which serverless becomes enormously important.
So it kind of removes the latency question from the user perspective using a service. Is there still a question in terms of the internals of when you are building an application as a developer and thinking about what callbacks you might be doing to backend services? Or do you think those will be co-located closer to the user as well?
I think some of them will be co-located. I also think just the fact that a platform like ours or others, they have really good connectivity to the internet. You know, in our case, we have our own fiber backbone, so we can move stuff without it going over the internet. I think it'll just be such a great developer experience to be on the serverless platform.
Right. And then you've also got the different connectivity types. You talked about 5G, and that's the latest technology that we're hopefully seeing being rolled out. But then there's satellite and Starlink, where there might be high throughput, but you've got quite significantly higher latency, but also in developing countries where the infrastructure is not quite as advanced and they might be several generations behind. Does that introduce different tiers potentially that developers need to consider?
Well, so Starlink's interesting because Starlink latency is pretty good. You know, you're talking tens of milliseconds. And the reason for it is that, you know, it's sort of easy to think, well, it's in space, so it's far away. And if you're old enough to remember transatlantic phone calls that went via satellite, there was a big delay every time you said something, but everyone had to pause and it was difficult to talk. The reality is those satellites are in low Earth orbit. They're only actually hundreds of kilometers high. And you think about hundreds of kilometers on the Earth's surface, it's really not far away. So in fact, the latency across networks like Starlink can be very, very good. And I know that they are trying to optimize for real-time gaming. So I actually think Starlink improves the latency situation enormously. When you think about internet access in different parts of the world, I think you obviously see it's obviously not uniform at all. And I think you see different environments. In some countries, Sudan, for example, pretty much everybody accesses the internet using mobile phones. In Switzerland, the opposite is true. Actually, desktop tends to dominate. So you have different technologies. But if you have a very large serverless network around the world, then, you know, where it's close to the end user, then no matter where they are, they can get a good experience and actually pretty much no matter what end device they're using. So I think the serverless platforms, the ones that are very, very large, actually can have a big difference on everybody around the world because they give you, the developer, a place to run code that you know is high performance and well connected to the internet, even if the end user's connection isn't as good as the lovely gigabit connection you have at home.
One of my favorite Easter eggs is in the Starlink terms and conditions about how their legal jurisdiction changes as you leave Earth and transit through space and then ultimately land on Mars. That introduces, currently hypothetical, but potential interesting questions around latency between Earth and Mars. Obviously, completely hypothetical. How would you think about architecting for that kind of problem?
Well, I mean, obviously, you can get relatively high bandwidth, but as you say, if you've watched The Martian, you may remember how many minutes Mark Watney was waiting for a reply every time he sent a question.
Right.
You know, the latency is enormous. So what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to move the data in the application to Mars, right? Or maybe in orbiting around Mars. So I think once we get to that point, no one's going to be doing anything interactive directly with the Earth. They're going to be doing anything interactive locally. And what will happen is all of the interesting stuff will be around synchronization between Earth and Mars, which is what, you know, this solar system serverless platform will have to deal with. So once again, I think this becomes not an application developer problem, but actually a problem for the platform to deal with.
So given that we're still quite early on in the development of serverless platforms, where do you see things going in terms of improving developer experience? So things like logging, error reporting, build, test, deploy cycles, that kind of stuff that's already quite mature in other environments.
You know, it's funny. I once attended a talk by Donald Knuth in Menlo Park. And at the end of it, somebody stood up and said, which do you think is the better language, Java or C++, which kind of dates when that talk was done. And he replied, which one has the better debugger? And I think, you know, you highlight the important point, right? Which is like, it's the tooling around what you're doing that really matters. And so, you know, debugging, logging, tracing are very, very important things. I also think that coordination is important. Like, you know, are you rolling out new versions? Are you coordinating a large number of services? You know, that itself is also a really important part of the platform. I think we are maturing now. We're definitely past the initial phases. We have hundreds of thousands of developers on our platform actually writing code, deploying things. It's clearly reached an inflection point, I think, where it is usable. And I think this will end up being the default way that developers think about building something that's exposed to the internet. They will just say, right, well, I'll just build it on a serverless platform because I don't have to worry about all sorts of features. And we see it from the people who use our platform that they just never even think about the scaling or load balancing or anything like that.
What does that mean for optimization and thinking about performance? Can you just throw hardware and resources at the problem?
Well, it depends what the problem is. Let's suppose you're trying to do, you know, a simulation of something in physics where you really are going to spend a lot of time optimizing how you do that and working on, you know, probably some high performance computing environment. That is going to be a very, very specific situation. I think, though, for the people like us, when we're building the platform, yeah, we can go out there and, you know, we can essentially throw hardware at the problem. I mean, we actually design our own hardware and roll it out around the world and have built a system that can bind together multiple generations of hardware in such a way that the end user has no idea. So I think the future is that you just shouldn't have to be thinking about the hardware or the operating system or the architecture. You should just be thinking about writing code in the language that you prefer.
And the constraints are changing and improving. Like, you've just increased the execution time, for example, on Cloudflare workers. Do you think that developers should just expect that to get better over time and the constraints they see today will be vastly improved in 6 and 12 months' time?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we are growing and building out our platform at the same time. So initially, we had constraints just as, you know, because we were overwhelmed with demand. As we've grown out, we've increased, and as we've seen the demand actually for other applications to be on our platform, yeah, we've increased the runtime constraints. I think eventually, yeah, I mean, this will become how people build stuff.
And how does that play into technology choices? So, for example, the V8 engine that Workers is based on is written in C++, but end developers write in JavaScript or anything that can compile into WebAssembly. Mm-hmm. And you're big users of Go and Rust internally. How do you think about those different technology choices?
Well, from our perspective, what V8 gave us was, you know, a highly optimized, very widely used, very well understood runtime environment, which we were then able to wrap around our own security features to be able to allow us to allow others to write code on our platform. We wanted to use V8 for two reasons. One was I was adamant that we support JavaScript from the beginning. JavaScript is the world's most popular language. And what you want from a platform is that people can get up and running with the language that they like. So that was one thing. And the other thing was that it was pretty clear that WASM was going to be a sensible way to take another language and execute it safely, especially if we had all the infrastructure in place for the rest of V8. So I think those two things together came together to say this is a good place to begin. Will we use V8 forever? I have no idea. You know, you can easily imagine a world in which in 5 years' time, there's so much WASM that maybe we want to do something entirely native with WASM, or maybe we've, you know, made silicon that runs WASM directly. But I think that it is clear that WASM is a very good target environment for a lot of languages. And what we'll want to do is, you know, allow developers to use their language of choice. So JavaScript was really the first. Obviously, we would support anything else. I mean, I personally got GNU COBOL running, and I have a demonstration up on the Cloudflare blog about how to write COBOL on our platform because it goes to WASM. Rust is fully supported by our platform. I think we'll just see these, you know, as WASM itself becomes more popular, our platform gets more popular. So I feel like the question about V8 is a little bit like the question about the target operating system or the target processor, which from an end user perspective, you shouldn't worry about it. You should just make sure that we run your code as fast and as securely as you need it to be run.
And how have you approached the security aspects of that? And I suppose being able to compile into WebAssembly is the key there so that you can do interesting things like changing how the data API in JavaScript is working internally so you can prevent those timing attacks. What can you tell us about your approach to the platform level security?
Well, we have a really long post actually about this on the developer region of the worker stuff for Cloudflare. But obviously V8 itself is highly scrutinized, right? Because it is in every browser out there. And of course, people would like to attack it. And we built an environment where, you know, once the V8 team revs something for security reasons, we can push it out very, very quickly within hours to our platform. We also sat down and built around V8 our own sandboxing so that we can control, you know, if somebody did manage to escape, what they would actually be able to get access to. And another thing we did was we were concerned about, you know, the effects of things like Spectre. And so we paid for or collaborated on research with the original Spectre finders, actually, to look at our environment and look at what we were doing. And of course, one of the nice things is because we control everything, we can arbitrarily move processes around, we can kill processes and restart them. And so we have a tremendous sort of toolkit for dealing with, you know, potential attacks on our platform. And it's something that the team actually from the very, very beginning spent a long time looking at, you know, to make sure that we thought we could actually safely run other people's code, because you can sign up for free and run the code today. And I think that it's something you never stop working on, but it is something that we think the combination of what we did and the work the V8 team does, it is a good platform to build, to write code on.
How have you managed to achieve that such rapid rollout speed across? You've got hundreds of edge locations around the world. How is that architected to avoid problems showing up in production and detecting those kind of things at scale?
So there's a few things. So the way in which Cloudflare works is we have an internal system called Quicksilver, which binds together all of those machines around the world and allows us to push out configuration to them. And that happens very, very rapidly, you know, in seconds to around the world. And we can push out, you know, changes to the WAF, changes to a customer clicks a button in their UI, it changes, and also push out code to the edge. So if you look at it, we already had that infrastructure in place. From an end user's code perspective, I mean, if their code fails in some way, that's their problem, right? If it's not behaving in the way they want it. We obviously are able to control, you know, time limits and CPU limits and all that sort of stuff like that so that their code can't harm others. But the real question is, how do we do it for our own software deployments? And actually, we have a staging environment. We have a dog fooding environment. We have stage rollouts. We have all sorts of monitoring going on. So we're able to do this. And we do software changes continuously on the platform. Over time, we have got pretty good at being able to spot when software is having problems and able to roll it back. The other thing I would say is we have a piece of software that's called Unimog, and there's various other variants of it called Plurimog and other things, which actually are monitoring the performance of every machine around the world and actually moving traffic around to keep us all at pretty much, you know, exactly the same CPU utilization around the world. So we can actually, you know, whether it's a third generation machine or a 10th generation machine, we're able to use its CPU effectively and safely.
Is that entirely automated? How's that evolved over time?
Yes. I mean, so it used to be entirely manual, right? So it's like, oh, that machine's a bit overloaded. Let's move some traffic around. Then we did a sort of semi-automatic mode where we did modeling of what normally happened, and we set up load balancing to machines based on that modeling. And occasionally we'd refresh the model. And by occasionally, I mean every few days or weeks, which isn't ideal, right? And then we set out to build this layer 4 load balancer, which is aware of the load on the machines in our global network and is able to move traffic around within a data center, but also actually move traffic from data center to data center so that the load is automatically spread. And it's incredibly effective. We basically run all the CPUs around the world at exactly the same level, no matter what the load is, because we're able to move the traffic and keep things flowing. And it's made us incredibly efficient.
Is that linked into how you handle very large DDoS attacks as well?
So yes and no. Large DDoS attacks are something we've been dealing with right from the very beginning at Cloudflare. You know, we'd always been a company that would deal with DDoS attacks. And over time, we built a entirely separate DDoS system. And actually, we have more than one. We have a system that operates independently on every machine, is able to detect a DDoS. And then we have one that fits together with all of the stuff and takes intelligence from the entire network. And this is one of those areas where you really want to get into low-level stuff, because you're trying to drop packets, trying to recognize packets that are bad and drop them very, very rapidly. And there's a whole team that works on that. And that that is something which obviously does affect CPU on the machines, but we do it in such a low-level way and with specific network adapter cards that we've got pretty good at being able to recognize and drop packets at incredibly high speed. In particular, using the express data path stuff in Linux has helped us a lot. Using a thing called eBPF, which allows us to recognize as particular packet types that run in the kernel very, very fast. A lot of this stuff has been built up over years to the point where, just the other day we handled an almost 2 terabits per second DDoS without any manual intervention.
Where do you see VMs and containers fitting into this as the classic building blocks of applications compared to the much smaller layers that the serverless functions exist in and then your own software layer?
Our guess is that some people will still want to run a container where they've set everything up and they want to give us the container. We're not ready yet to offer that service. I think that it is possible that we will. We've talked a little bit about our sort of thinking on this in the past. So it is likely at some point that becomes a, maybe we should be doing this on our platform. But moreover, we think that people are moving their applications to serverless, and it's not just functions, it's whole applications. And I think as that gets built out, it'll just become natural to not even worry about, the container with all of the dependencies, but say, oh yes, I can run it on this platform because that platform exists.
And does that make it a lot easier to do these lower level optimizations you're talking about with even the custom silicon when it's running on the serverless engine?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think, if you're able to control the environment you're running in, then yes, you can absolutely make all sorts of optimizations. I mean, the fact that we have hardware built for us allows us to pick exactly the CPU we want, exactly the memory, exactly the network card. And again, we can do the same thing at the software level where we can decide exactly what we're going to do. And it is inevitable that we will explore making our own silicon for some of this stuff because it will turn out to be the right optimization. But from the end developer's perspective, they shouldn't have to worry about any of that. It's like, oh yes, I just run my code on this incredibly inexpensive, incredibly flexible, scalable platform, and it just works.
And how do you think about aging out those different components of the infrastructure? Is that how it ties into your efficiency management layer? So even when you have the older generations of equipment, you can still manage them with the latest versions?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things we do, right? Which is that, so there's a financial component to this, right? Which is the depreciation on the hardware, right? So over time, you've paid for it essentially, right? The real thing to look at is what we really care about is requests per watt. So if you think about the fact that, once you bought the hardware, all the cost is around the power and cooling. So, how many requests per second can you do per watt of power, right? And so over time, when you look at the blended cost of running our service, at some point, some of those older machines start to look expensive because they're more power hungry per request. And so by having this Unimog software layer, we can make that decision based on non-technical reasons. It's like, oh, well, it's too old because we don't like, this machine because it's got DDR, whatever, memory in it. But it's like, oh, it's actually too expensive for us to run. And therefore, we can age that machine out and replace it with something newer. That has allowed us to be incredibly efficient. And one of the reasons why the business has done so well is that ability to really drive down the cost of operating the thing through software and, software on top of this platform.
Right. And the computational efficiency, but also the sustainability of the platform when you're thinking about carbon intensity per kilowatt hour and how that blends into your global estate of locations. How are you thinking about the sustainability? Is that just linked into the efficiency?
It's not just linked into the efficiency, right? So yes, we want to be more efficient, absolutely, because that makes sense from a financial perspective and from, a carbon perspective. But it's also like, how do we power this? And so, looking at where are we getting our electricity from? Where are we getting our cooling from? And so that's something we've been on a long journey around either buying offsets or directly sourcing power, which is from renewable sources. And we'll continue to do that. We have this thing called green compute, actually, where you can choose that your code will only run in data centers where we've already got to a acceptable level of, of carbon use, which I think is kind of a cool thing. And again, it's one of these things where if you don't have to worry about the machines and the operating system, all this stuff, is that you can literally press a button in the UI and say, I only want this run in data centers which are sustainably powered, which is pretty amazing.
So it's essentially a config flag, and you can trade off different things like locations that you require and the sustainability.
Yeah, and eventually, of course, you won't have to make this trade-off because we're pushing to make the whole thing sustainable, and then you won't have to worry. But if you want to do it today, you can absolutely do that.
Before we wrap up, I have two lightning questions for you.
Go for it.
So the first one is, what interesting dev tools are you playing around with at the moment?
I don't code that much anymore because the CTO role at Cloudflare, I started out as a programmer and I wrote loads of code. And then I ended up being the CTO and running everything. And now the CTO role is very much around outbound stuff, stuff like this interview with you, talking to customers, thinking about the longer term strategy things. You know, the tool I have actually been playing with is our own internal tool. So Wrangler, which is a tool for using our serverless platform. You know, I like to use our tools as an end user. And I actually have accounts on Cloudflare that I pay for out of my own pocket. So I see the real end user perspective. So that's the world that I've been playing with. The thing I really want to get into, and I never have time, and one day, this is my retirement plan, is there's a very interesting mathematical language called J. And one day, I'm going to sit down and really learn J properly, which will take me back to my original roots as an undergraduate mathematician.
Hopefully you can compile it to WebAssembly and run it on a worker.
Maybe that's what I should do. Get it running there, yeah.
And then the second question is, what is your current tech setup? What hardware and software do you use on a daily basis?
So I have sitting in front of me a MacBook Pro, which I, access everything from. I have probably, within striking distance of my desk here, about 8 Raspberry Pis, because I love Raspberry Pis. I love anything to do with microcontrollers, anything to do with small compute platforms. I have a house full of gadgets made out of those kind of things. But the Mac has become my world for a lot of things. And obviously from there, I can SSH into anything. And I have various machines around the world if I need to run something there. But more and more, I'm actually just using Cloudflare's platform to run things. It's just easy, and I don't have to worry about updating and scaling it.
Excellent. Well, that's all we've got time for, unfortunately. Where can people find you online?
Obviously, Cloudflare is where I work, but my website is jgc.org. It has various things about me, and obviously Twitter is my primary sort of public face, which is jgrahamc is my Twitter, and I'm very happy to interact with people there. I do it on a pretty much daily, maybe even hourly basis.
Excellent. Well, thanks for joining the Console podcast.
It was very lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time to have me and inviting me. And I hope people think about this serverless future and in particular tell us what we've got wrong, because I'm sure we've got a million things wrong.
Thanks for listening to the Console DevTools podcast. Please let us know what you think on Twitter. I'm at David Mitten, and you can follow at console.dev. Don't forget to subscribe and rate us in your podcast player. And if you're playing around with or building any interesting dev tools, please get in touch. Our email's in the show notes. See you next time.